not going to always be pretty. It's not going to always be perfect. And you just have to go with the flow and be that leaf floating in the breeze and end up where you need to be. I think there's always a bigger plan that you don't know about. And you just have to go where your heart takes you, and you're going to end up in the right spot. You can't have it all, and you just have to find the way to do it.
That's Dr. Ladjergren, vascular surgeon and mom, here today to speak about her experience navigating a career in surgery and motherhood. I'm Shannon Sue, Wiser co-president, and I'm joined today by podcast editor Julia Burns to bring you another episode in our Moms in Medicine series. Let's dive in.
I was born and raised in Florida, a small little beach town, Gulf Breeze. I lived in the same bedroom my entire 18 years before going to Florida State. I actually went to college to be a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer, and that's really all that I knew. I really didn't even know what I wanted to do, but I thought, okay, I'll be a lawyer. That sounds fun. I like to argue. And my first semester, I realized I wasn't super into being a lawyer. There's a lot of writing and a ton of reading and a lot of memorization of history, which wasn't my forte, but I really liked science. I really liked math. And I remember going to my advisor my second semester of my freshman year and saying, I really like being a student, and these are the classes that I'm really enjoying. She's like, have you ever thought about going to medical school? And I said, no, that sounds fun. Let's do that. And so then that was the trajectory that I ended up on. I struggled to get into medical school. I took one of the gap years. I had interviewed at a couple of places, but only got waitlisted my first year. So I started working at a community health center, took a couple of extra classes. My big struggle was the MCAT. I was always very smart, but never really understood how to study for a standardized test. But over that year, I just learned how to take a standardized test, did very well, got into a couple of programs, but really liked Florida State. I actually didn't know anything about medicine with regards to what kind of doctor I wanted to be. Doctor that I knew was actually a family practice doctor. She diagnosed 4 cancers in my mother, and I thought she was the smartest person. I said, I'm going to be a family practice doctor just like her. And so I really liked Florida State's mission for that. When I was a third year, I did OBGYN, and I really liked being in the operating room, very hands-on. I grew up playing competitive basketball, so I was very well coordinated. And I really liked being in the delivery room. I was very drawn to that. And I thought, I'm going to be an OBGYN. This is it. I'm going to deliver babies the rest of my life. I'm super happy. And the last rotation of my third year was surgery. And I fell in love. I remember going to the OR board and just looking at all the surgeries and being like, what can I go watch? What can I go touch? And Florida State was actually very unique because we didn't compete for time with residents. It was just a medical student and an attending. So you were in the community, and it was just you and the doctor. And so that experience being a medical student, I was assisting everything. I was closing everything. I thought, my gosh, how could I not be a surgeon? This is amazing. And I remember going to the campus dean saying, I'm super confused. I have built my entire fourth year around OBGYN. And he said, well, you just have to do what makes you happy. And so I quickly undid everything and was changing everything to be a surgery resident. I went down that path wanting to be in private practice. I never really saw myself in academics. I knew that I wanted to get through my training and go back and just be a bread and butter type of private practice surgeon. And my fourth year, I did an elective with a vascular surgeon. I remember being in the operating room, and he was so calm and confident. It was a simple toe amputation. And he said, why don't you go ahead and do that with the scrub tech? And I'm like, are you kidding me? This is crazy. I'm just a medical student. I've never done this before. And he's like, meh, whatever you mess up, I'm sure I could fix it. And I just thought, I want to be that calm. I remember him telling me, I'm trained in what every surgeon is afraid of. If anyone gets into bleeding, I'm who they call. And you certainly don't want to see me scared. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to be that confident. And then I started to realize what vascular surgery was. Essentially, it's a primary care doctor who gets to operate. The moment I have a vascular surgery patient, they are my patient forever. That includes young women, young men, people who are minding their own business and have a vascular injury. And that includes older people who have vascular problems. I get to see them periodically and hopefully never have to operate on them. But if I do, I'm trained in that. So that's how I got here.
That's so cool. I guess I never thought about it that way, that you guys are PCPs that operate on your patients.
And occasionally we're the only doctors they'll see. But do you have a primary doctor? Nope, just you. And you're like, okay, let's talk about medical management, all this other stuff controlled. I think that we are an opportunity to teach them that doctors are good and doctors care about them and they need to see more than just me. So it's a very unique spot a vascular surgeon gets put in.
Thanks so much for sharing about your background. As you know, our main topic for today is being a mom in medicine. Could you share at what point you started considering building a family?
Yes, I actually remember being a medical student and someone came and talked to us about freezing your eggs. And I remember thinking, oh, that's fun, but that's not even in my back of my brain, not even thinking about it. But I remember that conversation. A lot of women were tuned in and a lot of men were not. I never really remember thinking how important it was until I was a general surgery resident and I was very busy and single and not married and, oh, I have time, I have time, I have time. And then I became a fellow. And by this point, you're in your 30s and I still was single. I actually met my now husband my first year of fellowship at Emory, thinking we have time and I'm going to get through training and then I'm going to start private practice and eventually children, you know, we have plenty of time. And then I got into my first year of private practice. My mom was diagnosed with Lynch syndrome. I remember thinking, if I have that, I certainly don't want to pass that along to my children. And so that's what prompted me to go see an IVF doctor, a fertility doctor, and just talked about, if I do have it, is it possible that I could look for an embryo that did not have that gene and potentially have a healthy baby and not pass that along? And so that's really what took me into her office. And the answer, of course, was yes, whenever I was ready. So years kind of came and went, and I said, well, golly, I guess I better start thinking about children. I'm 36 years old. Like, what am I doing? This is pregnancies for a young person's game. So we tried, and after 6 months, we were not successful. And I thought, I have postponed this part of my life for 36 years. I just don't want to do it anymore. I'm ready to have my family. I'm ready to move on to that next part of life. And so I went back to the fertility doctor and I said, what can we do? I know that I'm older. I'm geriatric pregnancy now. And so she went through everything and said, we can start with pills or we can do this or we can do that. She said, your levels look pretty healthy. I bet that you'd be pregnant in a year if you wanted to keep trying. I said, I've postponed this. So I actually did IVF. We went through an egg retrieval. You hear all these stories. Oh, I got 30 eggs, 20 eggs, 13 eggs. And I thought, my goodness, that's scary. And then 13 eggs quickly turns to 10 embryos, 8 that made it to whatever day, and then genetically test these embryos, and quickly that drops down to 4. And so it was very scary, and it just makes me reflect back on that conversation that I was having when I was in my 20s in medical school and thinking, shoulda, coulda, woulda, or would I be in this situation? But obviously, hindsight's 20/20, but we had 4 embryos that were genetically normal. After my first implantation, I now have my son, Smith. He's 3. And I remember when the IVF doctor called and said, oh, you're pregnant. And I said, that took forever. She sort of laughed at me. Took forever. Like, that was lucky. And I was like, wow, lucky, really? That's so unfortunate that so many people go through this IVF game and are not successful or not that lucky. When Smith turned 2, I said, I'm ready to have a second baby. With IVF, you have the luxury of planning. Boy, was that a fallacy of my thinking. So we went through the entire year of 2023 trying to implant my next embryo. And 2 of my embryos did not survive. They were genetically normal, and it was quite shocking. At this point, I'm 38. And she says, well, we can go forward with your last embryo, or we can quickly try another round of egg retrieval. I did that. And I ended up with 12 eggs, and that quickly turned to 10 and then 8. We biopsied, and I ended up with 2 genetically normal embryos. And then I went to try to have that baby, and it was this happened, and then this happened, and then that happened. And now I was caught up in the IVF game, and it was emotional, a lot of tears with my doctor. But I had a chemical pregnancy with my first embryo transfer, and then I successfully had another embryo work. My second son, named Jack, is 5 months old, and I'm super excited. We are done with our baby journey, but when she called to tell me I was pregnant, I said, is this why you laughed at me 3 years ago? She said, yeah, this is the unfortunate truth of IVF. It is not this wonderful, magical, you know, here's some embryos and then here's a baby. It doesn't always equal out. And so I say all that to say, in your 20s, know your numbers. Go to the doctor. What's my AMH? What are my estrogen levels? What are my progesterone levels? Am I ovulating normal? When I decide I want to have a baby, is that going to be an easy thing for me to get pregnant, or is it going to be a hard thing for me to get pregnant? And when I started to talk about IVF at work, a little embarrassed about it. You just don't know what you don't know. And then this, you had IVF, and this person went through IVF, and I had my twins with IVF, and everyone's coming out of the woodworks with an IVF story. And so the embarrassment and a little bit of shame that I had quickly went away. And I just wanted to talk about it and tell people, be smart. I actually have a 23-year-old stepdaughter. And I said, we're going to the doctor. You're going to know your numbers. We don't have to do an egg retrieval and bank eggs, but you have to know, because when you're 35 and your AMH is in the dirt, you know, you're going to wish that you knew it at age 20. So I do have a lot of conversations about IVF. Know your numbers and be smart and educate yourself on your own body so that when you're ready to start your family, you have all that information.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that all with us. I know, very personal detail, but as you said, stories like this, they're becoming more and more common, and they can really impact and inspire a lot of our listeners. Would you mind sharing a little bit about what it was like going through all of this and being pregnant while also being a full-time surgeon?
So when I was looking for my first job, I got the contract and I was the first female surgeon they were even considering hiring. And at the time, I think we had 10 or 11 male partners. And I got the contract and all I was scanning for is, what's my maternity leave? And it wasn't on the contract. And the salary was fine. The vacation was fine. And I actually went back and I said, I don't care what the maternity policy is, but that's the only thing that's missing. And I just need to know, because I'm just so afraid. You know, we always end up on these Facebook groups of women surgeons talking about their maternity leave or the fact that they don't have one and they had to take all this call. And it was just all these like sad stories. And I didn't want to feel guilty about taking it. I said, I just need to know that it's in writing. And so they basically came back and said, this is what our maternity policy would be for you. And I said, fine, that's great. I will tell you, when I was pregnant and people would say, how much time are you going to take off? And I would say, I'm going to take off 3 months. And sometimes you'd be like, good for you. And sometimes they'd be like, 3 months, that's a long time. I'm like, 3 months is not that long, especially with a newborn. It takes 10 weeks to feel like a normal human being. And all I get is 2 weeks to enjoy it. So I just very much advocate, just know what it is, because I just felt guilty for taking that time or walking away from my group. And you just don't need all that extra guilt and shame. You just want to know what it is. The job that I took did not have that in the policy. And in fact, they actually did not have a paternity leave since me. That has now been written out. But that was something that I just thought that was so weird, that today's age, we don't even have that written down. So anyway, but I was there for about 3 years when I decided that it was time to start our family. I actually worked up until the Friday before I delivered that Monday. I was super impressed with myself. You know, vascular surgeons, you're on your feet a lot like every other surgical specialty, but we wear a lot of lead. So that was very heavy. I was really proud of myself that I didn't miss a day of work. But if I needed to miss a day of work, my partners would have been very happy for me to take time or do what I needed to do. I very much felt supported by them. All of my male partners are married. They have children. Their wives were working when they were pregnant as well. So I always felt supported, but I never asked for anything special. But I do feel like if I needed it, they would have given it to me or changed things around so that I could have been more comfortable. But I worked up until that Friday, had my baby on a Monday and was out for 3 months. When my 3 months was done, I went back to work and didn't miss a beat. I think a lot of people were surprised. I thought, well, that's what I did all these years of training for. Don't be too surprised. I was very lucky. I have a very supportive husband. He's a stay-at-home dad. So I think that transition was easier for me. Putting a baby in daycare is a hard thing that a lot of women go through. I'm very blessed to have a husband who puts our family first, and he's a stay-at-home dad. When I decided to have the second baby, I actually worked all the way up until the day before I was induced. Super proud of myself. I just feel like when you're in a supportive environment, you go to work, you wear your compression socks, you drink all your water, you sit when you can sit, you eat when you can eat. I didn't feel that burden of being a pregnant surgeon. I had that baby and I took my 3 months off. Two kids is a lot different than one kid. It's a lot. But at my 3 months, I went back to work and picked up right where I left off. I love my job. I love the people I work with. And I am super grateful to have a partner that lets me go to work and know that my babies are taken care of. I come home and hug and love on them, feed them and put them to bed and all that good stuff. So I definitely felt that support. And that's something to look for when you are looking at jobs. You can't ever know who you're getting into bed with, but you just have to feel supported by the people you're around. That's kind of how I feel about it.
It's really great to hear that you felt so supported by both your colleague, your partner, and everyone around you. If you're comfortable sharing, did you breastfeed after delivery?
My first son had a lip tie, and the breastfeeding journey was more of an emotional struggle for me than it was for him. I knew that's what I was going to do. This is where postpartum depression comes from. The inability to do something when you think you're smart enough to do it. That was the only thing I cried about. I thought, I am so smart. I have read the books. I have watched the movies. I have watched the YouTubes. I have talked to the lactation consultants. What am I doing wrong? And at the end of the day, it wasn't me. My first baby would latch and then he would do great. And then the next 14 times he would say, absolutely not. But I definitely tried. And it was a very emotional struggle for me to not be able to do it successfully. So I pumped. And at the end of the day, I was smart enough to know that the breast milk was the most important thing. And at 3 months, he was going to be on a bottle anyway, you know? So that was probably the hardest thing that I went through in the postpartum period was being so smart and it not working. And I just cried so much about it. And supportive partner, the baby's screaming and he's doing laps in the living room while I'm trying to regroup. I thought, this is going to work. I say that to say you just get tired of the struggle. And meanwhile, I pumped a lot. And so I just got on a pumping schedule and I thought, well, I'm smart enough to know how to exclusively pump. So I'm going to do that. So I was able to pump a lot and feed the baby, and that was the most important thing. So I tried, it did not work. And then second baby came along, and in the hospital, he latched great. And I thought, this is it, this is my opportunity. And then we got home, and he decided that he forgot how to do that. And come to find out, he had a tongue tie, which was really bad. I was feeding him with a bottle that looked like a nipple, because when you're breastfeeding and bottle feeding, you try to find something so there's less of a nipple confusion. I had this bottle and I was feeding him and he would just projectile vomit everything. I'm like, does my baby have pyloric stenosis? What is happening? His tongue tie was so bad that explained why he couldn't latch and successfully breastfeed. But number two, the bottles I was giving him was making all this happen. So once I was smart enough to end up on all of my Google searches and TikTok videos, I realized his tongue tie was really bad. So then I switched bottles and then he was eating successfully and I was on the pumping journey because I was like, I know how to pump. I can do this. So my second time around, I was less emotional about losing out on that breastfeeding journey, but I was able to pump for him and got him a bottle that worked. Then when I went back to work, I actually was able to pump for about 6 months with both babies and build up a freezer stash. When you're a busy surgeon, you sometimes feel guilty about taking the 20 minutes to pump at work. And sometimes I would pump and be typing on the computer, or I didn't even care who was in the room. I'm like, we're all doctors. I really didn't have a lot of shame with my pumping journey at work. I would just walking around with the breast pumps in my shirt and think twice about it. And no one made me feel bad, or if they did, I would have said, move on, it's fine. So I was able to pump for both of them for about 6 months. And then I was ready to put that away and move on to the next chapter. Pumping is a busy thing. You have to wash all the parts, clean and sterilize. It's its own beast. So I did it for as long as I felt it was necessary.
Well, I'm so sad that it was just a supportive environment. Kind of switching gears a little, now that you have not one, but two little ones at home, what new challenges have you been facing as a woman with a career in medicine, in surgery specifically, and then also being a mom?
You know, when you come home and baby goes to bed an hour and a half later, you feel like I'm missing out on so much and I only get to spend that 45-minute wake window before I'm putting him to bed. And it's this constant battle of I'm so grateful that I get to work and provide a life for my family. But it's also very sad that you almost feel like you're missing out on a lot of their life. And so that's a really hard thing to process. When I went back to work after the first baby and the second baby, that 3 months is actually really nice because baby does a lot of growth in that first 2 to 2.5 months. Then they get a little boring, right? You're just like, they're eating and they're sleeping and they're pooping. And you're like, all right, I'm ready to go back to work and I'll rejoin you when you move on to a new task. So it was fun to go back at that 3 month. And then you would come home and you would start to see the little bit of growth. But you can't spend a lot of time being sad about it. And again, I'm very grateful that I have a loving husband who enjoys being a stay-at-home dad. You know, you think about, should I have been a stay-at-home mom? And the answer is absolutely. I thrive in a work environment. I love going to work and seeing my friends and, hey, how are you doing? Let's go do some surgery together. I love doing my work. And my husband loves being a stay-at-home dad. So I think that that's a good partnership for us to have. But it was very sad. You only have that hour and a half time when you would come home, but it makes the weekends really nice. So I'm an early riser. I spend 4 hours just me and my boys. I let my husband sleep in. So for me, sleeping in is 7 a.m. and for him, sleeping in is like noon. So it works itself out. But there's so much more to the whole working mom thing that if you let the little detail of, well, Monday through Friday, I only get an hour and a half, bring you down, you miss out on all the other good stuff. I have a life that makes me very happy. When I come home, I'm happy. On the weekends, I'm happy. And I can afford a lifestyle where we can take trips and show them things I didn't have when I was growing up. So there's so much more positive. But that was a really tough transition with the first baby. And then with the second baby, not only do you get an hour and a half, but everyone has to eat dinner and everyone needs a bath and everyone has a bedtime. And now you're being pulled. So with one baby, husband and I could do that together. Now with two babies, we're on two baby duties. And then of course, when everyone's asleep, then you're too tired to talk to your spouse. That adds a whole new level of complication in there. So I'm a type A person. It's all scheduled. It's all very regimented. I mean, I have been through so many schedules of when I go back to work and when I come back, we're going to eat dinner as a family and do bath time. That has changed 4 times in the first 2 weeks of going back to work. So you just find what works for you and find what's most important. So for me, it was spending time with the baby one day, and then the next day it was spending time with my toddler, and then back and forth and trying to combine it as much as possible. It's not easy, but it is beautiful.
Yeah, very interesting to see how everyone does it differently, but it does come down to communicating with everyone around you and also being okay with things not going to plan. And you've mentioned a little bit of this already, but do you have any advice for the young women listening to this who want to start a family but also want to have a career in surgery?
The answer is you can't have it all. And I think that's the most important take-home message. It's not going to always be pretty. It's not going to always be perfect. You're not going to always live in the state you thought you were going to live in. You're not going to always have that certain job you thought you were going to have. You may not even marry the partner you thought you were going to marry, but you can have it all. You just have to go with the flow and be that leaf floating in the breeze and end up where you need to be. I think there's always a bigger plan that you don't know about. And you just have to go where your heart takes you, and you're going to end up in the right spot. I have met a lot of women along my career who never wanted children and never saw themselves being married and having that family dynamic. And that's okay. They are happy and they love life, and that is what they have chosen for themselves. And then there are other women who I have met who have 4 kids. I reflect on a general surgery attending I had who was a pediatric surgeon with 4 children. And I thought, well, golly, that's a busy life. But you can have it all. You just have to find the way to do it. And the other advice is there's no right time to have a kid. There is no right time to start a family. And if it's the right time for you, it'll work itself out. Just dip your toe into the world of possibility and you will get to the other side of that river. My entire 5 years of general surgery training, there was one girl who had a baby. And then after I graduated, lots of women in their surgery training started to have babies. And so you see one and then you think, okay, well, I can do it too. And talking about it is really important. But it does take a village when you're in training. You have to have people around you, whether that be a partner or family or somebody. It is messy, but it can be done. I would never encourage anyone to delay having a family if they want to start one. But I do think it's okay to realize that you want one later in life, and that's okay too. If you're not in a position where you want to start the family, like I didn't even get married until I was a fellow. And again, by this point, I'm in my early 30s. The only thing I would advocate is know your numbers. Just go to the doctor and say, if I wanted to have a kid tomorrow, can I do that? And what does this look like? If I want to delay it until I'm in my 30s, what is that going to look like? And you would be surprised that there's a lot of people who go to the doctor in their 20s and they do have a ticking clock because their egg reserve is low, or they don't ovulate normal and all that stuff. But you don't know it until you know it. All the information is really what's going to help you plan the life that you've always envisioned for yourself. So just educate yourself now. I mean, you're incredibly smart. You know everything about medicine when you're coming out of medical school and when you're coming out of residency. And just sometimes remember that you need to be a patient too and advocate for yourself. And actually, there are some medical schools out there and even some academic affiliated programs actually pay for egg harvesting or IVF. So I wish these big academic places would put that all over the website. Imagine how many more women they would attract. I think that's just so glossed over. And I don't know why. We all think about it and we all care about it. And I wish every academic program would support their female people that way. So just look into that. If you're interested in going to these places, ask if they do that. some of the programs are starting to really promote that they take that sort of stuff seriously. And good for them. I mean, how could you not want to support the smartest women? I don't know how to say this in a nice way, but we should be having babies if we want to have babies. And good for the academic programs to support that.
On that note, we'd like to thank Dr. Lagergren for sharing her story and all the many life lessons she sprinkled throughout this episode. Our Moms in Medicine series is coming to a close with our final episode, which we will post in the next few weeks, featuring Dr. Schmidt. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to another episode of Wiser. If you liked this episode, please rate and leave us a review as it helps others find the show. You can also share it with friends and family. Please follow us on social media at Wiser Podcast for updates. This episode was hosted by Shannon Sue and Julia Burns. Production and editing was done by Megan Wasson and Shannon Sue. Music is courtesy of Blue Dot Sessions.